A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 130. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of Pathfinders in Space. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Yes, we are talking about a black and white children's adventure show about space exploration, several series that came out in 1960 and 1961, and of interest to us for a number of reasons, but not least the fact that created for ABC television by one of the sort of godfathers of Doctor Who, certainly one of the creators of Doctor Who, Sidney Newman. So some interesting stuff in this early children's television.
Yes, absolutely. And this was part of his attempt to introduce some real science and some more definite or hard science fiction ideas into children's television when the real space race was just starting to pick up. And there are 21, 25-minute episodes from these three serials, Pathfinders in Space, Pathfinders to Mars, and Pathfinders to Venus. All of those are available. There was an earlier show that it spun off of called Target Luna, and that actually doesn't survive. It's missing. But the three later ones do.
So last time we discussed how the Professor Wedgwood and his children get involved in a rescue mission when the professor's moon rocket badly needs supplies. And that was the success of Pathfinders in Space, the first of these series that we're discussing, which, as you say, had built on the earlier success of Target Luna. And again, a very successful show, and so very quickly got a sequel, Pathfinders to Mars, again written by Malcolm Hulk and Eric Pace, and again directed by Guy Varney. And this time we have 6 episodes, I think, Brian, again about 25 minutes each.
Yes, that's right, and we have some characters from the previous serial, and we have some new characters. We have another moon rocket. This one is MR3. These are, you know, we end up seeing MR1 through MR4. And in this case, Professor Wedgwood is actually injured, I think from something related to setting up a rocket on the ground or some such thing. So the science journalist and former pilot, Henderson, becomes the central character, the hero, and the main pilot. We also have Professor Mary Meadows, played by Pamela Barney, and she was there in the previous serial from MR1, and she is back as one of the crew members this time. And one of Professor Wedgwood's children, Jeffrey Wedgwood, is back and once again on the crew and helping to fly this moon rocket.
Yes, that's right. But this time his youngest children, Jimmy and Valerie, they're not there at all. We don't see them. But instead, again, I suppose to attract or interest its youthful audience, we have another young character. We have Henderson's niece, Margaret, who's shown as a very sort of bright academic young girl, and she joins the crew. So we've got a crew, as we've said, we've got the four characters we've mentioned so far. We get Hamlet, the guinea pig, yet again voyaging into space in a slightly sort of stretches our credibility, but there he is. Hamlet's making another trip.
Yes, so one could almost argue that that Hamlet the guinea pig is the central character of this entire series, right?
Yes, you could watch the whole show just from his point of view.
And we also have another scientist joining the crew, but it turns out that there is an imposter. We don't really have this scientist that we thought was going to be joining the crew, but we have this man called Harcourt Brown, who has strange ideas and ambitions about the planet Mars and other planets in the solar system. And he has some beliefs about there being all kinds of life and civilizations and all kinds of things elsewhere in the solar system.
Yes, it's a bit strange how characters like Harcourt Brown and the children continually defeat the security of this sort of Buchan Island rocket base. But there you go. That's, I suppose, some of the conventions of children's adventure television we have to put up with, Brian.
It does seem to be very easy to get into space in this series.
Yes.
And to swap people around with who's getting into space. And to change your mind about where you're going. Well, maybe instead of the moon, we should go to Mars. Just change our route. You know, those sorts of things seem to be very easy in this particular show.
That's right. And talking of changing characters, should mention, I think you spotted, Brian, that the scientist who's supposed to be on board MR3 with the crew was played by a well-known Doctor Who actor, Bernard Horsfall.
It's always lovely to see Bernard Horsfall show up. He's a very watchable actor. And, of course, we saw him on multiple occasions in Doctor Who, memorably in The Deadly Assassin in the Tom Baker era, but he showed up other times. He has been in Big Finish audios. We saw him in the anthology series Beasts. So he has been in quite a number of things, and it was fun to see him show up so early in his career in a few episodes of Pathfinders to Mars.
Yep, absolutely. A very recognizable British actor. Once you've seen him, you'll see him in lots of stuff. And here he is, being one of the few characters in these serials actually finds it difficult to get into space because somebody's taken his place.
That's right.
So we've got a bigger budget this time. We've got the huge budget for the time of £3,000, which allowed for improved rocket sets, and the crew get less bulky spacesuits and helmets, which were redesigned. They still don't have any glass in the front of them and still have this cross wire appearance to try and convince us they've got glass in them. But perhaps I think the most impressive, and this sort of gives the game away, but was the Martian landscape they reach, with, according to the production notes, the set designers having to use brand new plastics that had recently been developed, combined with some very impressive painted backdrops. And for a television series in the, you know, the very early 60s, not a bad job, I think, on the sets, Brian.
Yes, this was a time where we were basically talking about the types of sets and visuals they would use from live theater being set up in TV studios for sort of mostly live types of recordings and performances. So yeah, they did some nice things for the time with that. And of course, in Pathfinders to Mars, it's not surprising that we will get to see a Martian landscape somewhere along the way.
That's right. And they'll also encounter some plant life. And again, this produced a rather strange special effect using what they could at the time. I think it now looks fairly obvious what the special effect is made of when you see it. But, you know, they were backroom boys basically inventing new stuff as they went along, I think. So quite fun.
Yes, some fun things there and quite cleverly done with the things that were available at the time. This was shown in the same Sunday tea time slot as the first two serials were shown, even with an episode on Christmas Day of 1960. And it was very popular. It was very successful. The only broadcast with a higher audience at Christmas time was the Queen's annual Christmas broadcast. So that was sort of remarkable that it was in the number two slot behind that.
Absolutely. Of course, this was a time when absolutely everybody who had a television set watched the Queen's broadcast. So, you know, to come in as the second most popular show of the day behind that was quite a triumph for this children's TV show, and just shows, I suppose, a little bit about what watching television was like back then. We've had similar stories when we talked about Quatermass and how popular that was in 1984. And here we are again with a very popular black and white science fiction show.
I'm not Hawkins. My name is Harcourt Brown.
Harcourt Brown?
The man who wrote people from the planet.
Now come on, open up this hatch.
I'm giving the orders now. I'm in charge of this rocket, and I'm taking it to the planet Mars.
You know, they galloped on straight into the next story. From Pathfinders of Mars, we went to
Pathfinders to Venus. And this was rather interesting because, unlike the beginning of Pathfinders to Mars or the beginning of Pathfinders in Space, where they are on the ground organizing and setting up who's going to be on this rocket and launching a rocket, it didn't start like that. It started when they were all still out in space on the rocket, MR-4. And they pick up this mysterious distress signal and divert to Venus instead of going back to Earth. And this was broadcast in March of 1961. So this was quite soon after Pathfinders to Mars had finished.
Yep, the cast and crew getting virtually no time off in between these serials. And here we have the same cast, the same characters. Again, we've got the writers, Malcolm Hulk and Eric Pace, and Guy Verney directing. But this time we have a planet, which interestingly they knew an awful lot less about at the time. Unmanned probes hadn't reached Venus, and so what they had to work with was entirely speculative, really. So they have Venus, and they're going to get there. They've got this mysterious distress signal to investigate. Again, they've got some new sets and some new special effects. And interesting stuff happening to us yet again.
Yes, absolutely. And we had some model work by Derek Freeborn, who built all of the models for the Pathfinder series. And we even had some scenes with dinosaurs of a sort, taken from a 1955 Czech film called Journey into Prehistory.
Yep, we're sort of giving it away. They do reach Venus, and yes, there are some clips of what appeared to be dinosaurs, so you can probably figure it out. But it's a remarkable sort of rescue tale. And it's interesting because, as you said, Brian, this was the space race was starting to hot up. And this serial did show a certain degree of cooperation and working together between the various countries that would be exploring space. And again, science fiction being quite sort of optimistic and open in its attitudes to competition and cooperation.
Yes, this was the first one where they started to really get into more of the politics of who was going into space and how the different countries and different space programs were interacting and what the different groups were planning and so on and so forth. That was different from what was in the previous ones. You know, in the previous ones, it was all about this British group going into space. And in the second one, this guy Harcourt Brown finding his way in, and that sort of gave you an extra twist to things that wasn't in the previous one. And in this case, the extra twist was the idea of the multiple different space programs from different countries and distress calls and this sort of thing.
So it was good fun, interesting politics for the time. And another little interesting snippet about Pathfinders to Venus, which we learnt from the rather helpful and comprehensive production notes booklet in the DVD set. The seventh episode, we've got, this is the longest serial, we've got eight episodes here, and the seventh episode was used as the basis of an academic study into children's responses to television carried out by, I believe, the University of Cambridge, their education department. And basically what they did was they showed the seventh episode to groups of children and asked the children all sorts of questions about what they'd watched afterwards and produced a report. And quite interestingly, Sidney Newman later said that having seen the results of the study, what it taught him was that young audiences would forgive the minor slips and gaffes that appeared in television of the time, but that they wouldn't forgive or they couldn't be fooled by poor storytelling. And it's sort of impossible to read that comment without thinking in a way of some of the success of what would happen with Doctor Who and whether or not he took some of that, the results from that study with him when he moved to the BBC and commissioned what would become Doctor Who. It's interesting stuff, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And there certainly was something of a focus on storytelling and getting that right in some of the very early parts of Doctor Who. So that's kind of interesting. There was a caption at the end of that episode that said something about the mistakes in this episode were deliberately there for part of an academic study. They weren't really mistakes, which was a little unusual to see.
Yes, because they hadn't put anything like that with all the other mistake-ridden episodes, but there you go.
Well, yes, that's true. It's also sort of interesting that Gerald Flood and Stuart Guidotti, who played a couple of the major characters in this, went on to make a couple of other series. One of them was Plateau of Fear, which I believe may be missing. We haven't seen a whole lot of information about that. And also City Beneath the Sea, which is actually available. So some of the people from this continued on to make some other science fiction not too much later, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Some more interesting 1960s science fiction, which, who knows, we may get to one day.
We may yet.
So I guess we should start to talk about our views on Pathfinders in Space, the whole series, the good and the bad parts. Brian, what would you like to pick out as the good bits for us?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is an interesting show in many ways because of what it says about the time it was made and this sort of thing. This very much feels like the 1950s children's television, which, of course, was very limited. But then this sort of has some extra levels being added onto it. So it feels like some of the very early stages of trying to move beyond some of these very basic children's shows that were very early onto adding a little bit of Quatermass type things of discovering what's out there in the universe with the professor, as you had in the first story. And then I did sort of like some of the wrinkles that they added into these stories with the professor and those later on parts in the first serial. And in the second serial, the idea of Harcourt Brown compromising the mission and the ideas of what he believes is out there, and can you really trust that, or do you need to be more skeptical, and those kinds of ideas. And then this sort of more political stuff in the third serial. So I rather like those sort of extra wrinkles they were adding in here.
Okay, yes. I mean, it is interesting for its time. As you say, very much sort of classic children's adventure stuff, and the ease with which the children can get around security and get involved in these various space missions is a little bit laughable now, but I suppose it was fairly standard stuff at the time. We've got that early sort of science stuff, the Irene Sutcliffe character in the first serial trying to explain the science both to the cast and to us. And interestingly, in a way, I think they sort of dropped that the further it went on, and the science becomes more and more speculative, and the stories become more and more fantastical, I suppose, as the series progresses. And in a way, I guess they just get back to more traditional adventure fare, particularly by the time we get to Pathfinders to Venus, and sort of science stuff is almost left out completely.
Yes, that's right. We certainly have a lot of the 1950s children's adventure type show here, which is a little bit unfortunate. A lot of the things with the children and with, dare I say, Hamlet the guinea pig can be a little bit difficult to watch, actually.
Yes, obviously we've got, you know, child actors, child characters supposed to be the way into the story for its young audience. And of course, as you say, the Hamlet the guinea pig. But interestingly, particularly if you read the comments on the IMDb page for this show, some people who watched it at the time said, well, they weren't really interested in the children because the children annoyed them. And what they were more interested in was the adult characters and their adventures in space. So whether or not it was what kids at the time wanted, who knows? But they do become, they're a little bit irritating at times, the children and the child actors. And particularly this fact that Hamlet the hamster goes everywhere and goes into space. Sorry, the guinea pig.
Yes, it's kind of bizarre at times. I think in many ways, this series does improve as it moves further along. I think having the two children rather than the three children in Pathfinders to Mars and Pathfinders to Venus, I think that was a little bit better, and there was more realization that it wasn't just about the children and they could do some other broader types of things. The characterization was not all that great for the most part, but as they brought some more interesting character conflict in with the character of Harcourt Brown, and then the sort of secrecy with what the different space programs were doing and this sort of thing, it became a little bit more sophisticated, I think. Although you didn't have as much of the real science, and you had more of, you know, discovering things on the moon or discovering what different countries were doing and that sort of thing. But I thought as other types of characters came in, it became a little bit more interesting.
Okay, we've got the performances, which we've hinted at. Child actors perhaps being a bit annoying at times. The adult performances, I think for their time, they're pretty much standard, I would guess, Brian.
Some were better than others, I thought.
Yeah.
Gerald Flood, I thought was okay. And the guy who played Professor Wedgwood also was okay. You know, nothing too special, but okay. The woman there who was on the missions, who was supposed to be Canadian, performance was not all that great, I thought.
No, it has problems, and her accent seems to vary as the series progresses, and she becomes a sort of romantic interest for Gerald Flood's character, Henderson. But there you go, yes, she was there. The sets and the effects and models, I think they're of their time. They were obviously trying extremely hard and sort of making this stuff up as they went along, and sometimes to good effect, although sometimes now we look back at the helmets and the floating against black velvet backdrops, and we can't resist the occasional giggle.
Yeah, some of the things with, like, the flyovers of the moon, and some of those things were actually cleverly done and, you know, better than most things that existed at that time. So that was kind of neat to see some of those types of things.
Okay. We have to try and keep in mind shows from a similar time, I guess, to compare it with, and have to wonder how it compares to stuff like Quatermass or other black and white shows we've discussed, like The Invisible Man, and of course, I suppose, Doctor Who. Where would you put it in that grouping, Brian?
Well, I would say that the more science-oriented adult-type shows, Quatermass and also A for Andromeda, are in a different class altogether. I thought those were much better than this, but they were also very different. They were trying to do entirely different things for a different audience.
Yeah.
The Invisible Man has some things in common with this, I guess, in terms of child actors and some basic things. A fairly different show, but you can see that they sort of come from a similar era and a similar heritage.
That's right, yes, they are. I mean, I think The Invisible Man would probably be the show that we could closest compare it to from the ones we've discussed. Again, from the ITV network, again, with slightly strange special effects now. And does look quite rather quaint and dated, but interesting to compare it to that show.
Now, by the time Doctor Who came out a couple of years later in 1963, it had a completely different feel to it by then. I think that was much more forward-looking and felt much more a part of the 60s than this does. This feels like it is a 1950s-style show with just a few things added into it, where the early Doctor Who, even at the very beginning, felt very much like it was pushing into the 60s and doing different sorts of things with some different types of characters and performances, and was really quite different.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting how much difference 3 years makes and how much better Doctor Who was than this. I'm just really wondering how much Sidney Newman learned from this experience, and also perhaps interestingly from that little academic project done on one episode, what he learned and what he took with him, because not long afterwards he would be moving to the BBC.
Yes, absolutely. Now, something else that fits into that is that Doctor Who was not made by the children's department at the BBC. It was made by the drama department, which meant that everyone involved, they were people who were coming from adult drama rather than from children's programs. And it was specifically something that was being made for adults and children, not just for children, where the Pathfinder series was really made for children. And it was at a time when I don't think they had yet figured out how to do more interesting and more sophisticated shows for children.
Right. Okay. I mean, that is an interesting feature of Doctor Who in the early days, as you say, very much intended for the whole family. And, you know, we're a similar sort of remit to try and educate and inform as well as entertain. There is a change and a difference. And it's interesting to look back at one of these sort of, I suppose, distant ancestors in a way. The other nice thing we should mention about Pathfinders is the fact that it exists at all, because we don't have much television, and particularly not much science fiction fantasy television from that era. So it is nice that it survives and we've got it to watch.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Having complete serials from 1960 and 61 is very unusual. There are very few things from that era that exist in complete form. So this is really nice to see. So absolutely, it's nice to have this sample of some of the things from that era.
On the existence of life on other planets. As we travel towards Earth, the largest thing in our periscope is the planet Venus, which, as you know, is...
Something coming through on our wave band.
One moment, please. Why, what is it?
Well, it must be Buchan Island trying to correct our signal strength.
That's funny. It's not on our wave band. It's crashing through it.
I'll put it through on the loudspeaker.
SOS, SOS, clear the air, please. This is urgent.
Well, who's that? That's not Buchan Island.
Shh. I've lost it. It's changed frequency.
Well, Buchan Island's on a fixed frequency.
I don't think that was Buchan Island.
Sounded like an American voice to me.
SOS, SOS, is anyone receiving me? This is urgent.
Well, it's not for us. It's probably a general SOS call for an American station.
That call didn't come from Earth. It's from somewhere in space.
Oh, don't be silly, Jeff. It can't be.
Well, look at the direction finder. It's pointing away from Earth.
In what direction?
I don't know. It looks about...
So, I think that leads us neatly into our recommendations. So, Eamon, what do you have to say about the Pathfinder series?
Okay. Well, I think you've probably gathered as we've gone along that this is a series that we have some problems with. And what I keep trying to remind myself is to sort of view it with the eyes of the audience from the time and not with our sort of modern CGI special effects and high quality editing programs in mind. It is very much of its time. It's an interesting children's show from the very early 1960s. A lot of it is quite laughable. I think it's probably one for people who are interested in the history of television and interested in this particular era and would like to see something from that time. I don't think it's going to be the first pick DVD set for the majority of people. And I think, you know, if we had to compare it with, say, a Doctor Who serial from the first Doctor, I don't think there'd be any contest, Brian. We'd recommend picking the Doctor Who, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. I'm basically going to agree with most of what you said there. I really have no problem with the visuals and the effects from this show. Sure, they were basic, but that's fine. What I find bother me with this are things like the performances and the writing and what they were doing with these stories. And if you are interested in seeing something from this time period and seeing this sort of early children science fiction, if that is an interest of yours, if you are trying to put together some of these sort of historical ideas of how television looked at the time, then this is a great sample of it. Otherwise, you know, if you're not particularly interested in older children's fare, then I would say this is probably one you can skip. So not a big recommendation for this one.
Okay, so guarded comments from us here. But as ever, if you remember Pathfinders to Space, or if you've watched a DVD set more recently since its release in 2011, we'd be fascinated to hear what you thought. And we look forward to getting your comments either by email, or on the webpage, or on the Facebook group.
Absolutely. I would love to hear from someone who watched this in 1960 and 61 and then came back to it more recently. I would love to hear that perspective.
Please let us know what you think.
So, in summary, Pathfinders in Space, Pathfinders to Mars, and Pathfinders to Venus were three serials from 1960 and 61 that dealt with a group of characters, including a group of children, who found their way into these rockets that were intended to go to the moon. And they went to the moon and they explored and discovered things on the moon. And then they were able to go to Mars and finally to Venus to see the things that were there. And they ended up with a character who was an imposter sneaking his way on. And there were conflicted things there and different ideas about what might be out there in the solar system. And then we had people from other space programs, not from Great Britain, but from other parts of the world, and interactions with them, all in a 1950s style children's television serial.
Okay, a fantastic bit of television history. And as we've said already, please do jump in and let us know what you thought about it.
Definitely a slice of history.
And of course, come back to us next time when we will be spending our next two episodes again exploring space, but this time right up to date, talking about a show called Voyage to the Planets, also known as Space Odyssey. And this was a BBC and the Discovery Channel co-production from 2004. And lots of interest in science and special effects for us to talk about here, Brian.
Yes, very different and much more up-to-date than science-heavy exploration of the solar system. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We are part of the Geek Culture Network, so if you go to thegeekculturenetwork.com, you can find us there. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, we are there as well. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and until next time, this is Eamon in England saying, guinea pigs in space!